Hello, welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and this is a little different episode. Joel is missing, but instead of Joel, I have the Kill by Kill crew, Patrick and Gina.
Hello, everyone.
Hello!
Hey, thank you guys for coming on for this kind of stupid idea I had.
Stupid ideas are the best ideas.
Yeah, we wouldn't have a podcast if it wasn't for stupid ideas.
I mean, if I could tell you how many times people have messaged me with, I have a stupid idea, and I'm like, yes.
You've piqued my interest.
You go on.
Yeah, so this dumb idea is, we're going to be done the podcast by mid-October. So I wanted to do a Halloween thing again, so I decided since there's Christmas in July, why not Halloween in April?
Why not Arbor Day in February?
There are no rules anymore. We're doing whatever we want. God is dead and we rule.
Why not 4th of July in May?
This is like a Jack Trick chick tract.
Fuck the law. Come to life.
I am a god.
So for this Halloween special coming out in April, we're going to do Tales from the Hood because it's produced by Spike. And I've always heard about this movie. I just avoided it for a long time because the title made me... I learned early on, like, if Hood or, like, Ghetto is the title of a movie, it probably sucks. And so, for that reason, I kind of avoided this movie for a very long time, and I like it overall. It's fun, but, like, you know, it definitely isn't, it definitely has aged. It's like a relic of the 90s, certainly.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's an anthology movie, and particularly the anthology horror, it's very hit or miss. Yeah. And I think that, with the possible exception of Creepshow, when you're looking at any horror anthology, you've got maybe one or two good ones and a couple of clinkers.
I think that's part and parcel with what you get, is not every single one is going to be as great just by the very definition of it. It's very rare to come across that sort of thing. And it's very individual as well. I mean, I know people in this world who believe that Creepshow 2 is better than the original Creepshow. So that's just going to say, like, not everything here is going to be for everyone. But I do feel like there's a couple here that are better than I remembered them. And there's a few here that I wondered how they made the screen. But I will say this. The wraparound, maybe not the story so much, but Mr. Sims is, in my mind, a horror icon that has not been elevated nearly enough. That performance is fucking amazing.
Yeah, Clarence Williams III and Rosalind Cash, who plays like the prison doctor at the end, they're doing Shakespeare. They're like emoting and really getting into this, like, you know, corny kind of, you know, horror anthology. They're taking it very seriously, and I, you know, it really just kind of, it kind of makes almost every other performance in the movie seem far worse by comparison.
It's so committed and it's so over the top that it's projecting a very distinct kind of movie that some of the other components of it have trouble living up to just by their story structure or how they're supposed to operate, but they are on another level. I mean, Clarence Williams III is literally acting with every pore that he has, and it's astounding. I mean,
he's kind of carrying over his performance from I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, which again, he's very dramatic and very emotive, and in that, it's the same thing. It's supposed to be kind of funny how you know, dramatic he is in it, and I just love it. Every minute he's on screen is just wonderful to me.
It's so out of step.
The part for me when I like realized that he was great, he's the best part, was when he's like, shit, the shit. You'll be knee deep in shit.
Yeah, there's a devoted insistence on constantly referring to drugs as the shit. And I think that phrase is used roughly 345 times in the course of an hour and a half movie.
Well, what is the, now in terms of rate of something that is repeated, do you think the shit is said more than motherfucker? Because I think motherfucker might in fact rank into the four digits in this movie. It is less of a spice and more of the main protein.
Oh yeah.
I'm no shrinking flower when it comes to language. But in, especially in that fourth one, motherfucker gets said so much that I wonder what that page must have looked like. Or were all the motherfuckers just added for fun along the way? And then the editing, they're like, wow, there's a lot of motherfuckers in this particular subsection of this movie.
Yeah.
Do we want to break down each segment, or is this going to be kind of like an overview of like the whole thing?
Every segment, but first of all, I'll talk about Rusty Cundiff.
Sure.
Bring him up a little bit, because he and Spike Lee are friends. Rusty was in School Days as one of the frat brothers, and a frat run by Giancarlo Esposito. And he has a couple key lines, but it's kind of like blink and you miss him in that movie. And he's also in Hollywood Shuffle. I think he plays a slave in the Hollywood acting school segment.
Right.
But, like, I know... And, and, like, I feel like the main reason this movie got made is because he and Spike are friends. And because Spike was a producer on this. And he also produced a sequel, unfortunately. But Rusty is an interesting guy. He directed a lot of Chappelle Show. So, like, he knows comedy, just sometimes his sense of humor doesn't really come through.
Yeah, I think the primary issue I had with this movie, and it was okay. I thought it was okay. It's very inconsistent in tone, and that's a problem in a lot of horror comedy, and why a lot of horror comedy doesn't work. Like, I just find it, when you have a segment that has to do with the predominant subject is child abuse, you shouldn't have a sight gag where a bird shits on someone. It's just weird, yeah. and I feel like he couldn't really decide if the villains in the movie were supposed to be scary or kind of buffoonish, so he makes them both at the same time, which kind of, you know, mutes the dramatic element a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know, like, cause like, there you go.
No, I was gonna say like David Alan Greer just for me does not play a very convincing villain.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought for my money, that segment is far and away the best one.
It's the best one. It's the best one because it's the most clever one. And I do, I mean, although I do think it's weird how the mom kind of hits on the teacher, and it's like,
well, I think she's supposed to also they're going after a, you don't know exactly what the deal is, because the most obvious thing is that his stepfather or father, because you really don't know when it begins, is abusing him.
Well, as the story
progresses, you're not sure. Does this kid have magical powers? Does he in fact live with a monster? Does his mom turn into the monster? Does his stepdad turn into the monster? Does he have a separate id that is this monster? And it there's a mystery element to it that I really enjoyed this time. And yes, I agree. David Alan Greer is coming with a lot of history.
Yeah, I just felt really weird to hear him say, you're next, bitch. it's not very convincing.
I don't know. He always has because he has that a soldier story background to him, I buy him in dramas. Like, he is Shakespearean trained. So I was, for me personally, that doesn't discount your experience in the least. I found him pretty convincing because he comes off like he's, everyone is so afraid of him that by definition, you kind of have to be afraid of him. And then when he does start beating the living hell out of people, guess what? He beats the living hell out of them. It is, he fucks everyone in that house up before his, you know, comeuppance, as it were.
Yeah. But I don't know, like, at the same time, like, I think that point, like, because like, he's not, like, a big intimidating guy, which is part of the surprise.
Yes.
But at the same time, since it's in a, this is an anthology film, you're like, well, he's here, so he's probably being abusive. Because, like, by that point, it's like you're trying to figure out the mystery. So it's it kind of a strange thing of, this, like, I don't know, like, maybe add another character, but then they go on for a little too long.
Well,
but at the same time, that's my favorite segment of the whole.
Yeah, it's the most well done, and it's one that seems to have a consistent, other than the, you know, the bird shitting on the teacher for no good reason.
Right.
It seems to be most consistent in tone, and I feel like that's the one he kind of came up with first. And I mean, what Patrick says is a good point that, you know, there is a certain sense of, well, maybe the kid is kind of making it up, or maybe he, you know, just this, you know, weird evil kid that has this power. I think the problem for me is I had seen this movie before, and that was the only segment I really remembered. So the kind of mystery element of it was lost for me because I knew that he was that the monster was the stepfather, and so that kind of lost the dramatic impact for me. But it's still the best one. You know, I do like the concept of, you know, whatever this kid does, this drawing, it happens to him. That's pretty clever. I like that aspect of it.
It's a weird mashup of other anthologies throughout this, because you can feel the specter of Tales from the Dark Side here, where they're like, I'm waiting for a Zuni fetish doll version, and then lo and behold, you get one. And I'm sort of waiting for that Amicus one where, you know, someone's biggest fear comes realized at their worst possible moment. And so it's remixing very classic portmanteaus and trying to reconfigure them. And in typical portmanteau fashion, like some anthologies work better, some do not. But that far and away was the best one. It's just, it's structured in all the right ways, with the exception of the bird shitting, which makes me now think that means something that I don't understand. And I'm kind of okay with that. Like, is there a significance to this that I am simply culturally missing?
I mean, if you're seriously asking that, I mean, do supposedly if a bird shits on you, it means good luck.
Right.
I don't know if that's what he meant by that or if it means anything, but you know, that maybe he meant he was protected or something. I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe because Rusty is like a comedian, working comedy. Maybe it's a joke. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but that's it. And you know, it stops, you know, dramatic moments by putting a joke in there. Like, you've got this first segment, which is just, it's bad. It's bad, bad, bad. With the evil cops. And you've got these kind of very buffoonish cops played by Wings Hauser and a guy from The Crow. I mean, I feel terrible. Every time I see that actor, I think, oh, that's the guy that accidentally shot Brandon Lee. Because it is.
I was going to ask.
The guy who ends up in the mural at the end for some reason. His name is Michael Massey, and he will forever be known as the guy that accidentally shot Brandon Lee. And, but they're just so kind of, they're evil, but they're also stupid. And it's, you know, like, there's a part where you've got this, he's like a community, you know, leader who they kill, and they is a, you know, some sort of, because they're trying to cover up that they beat him up, and, you know, another cop, you know, saw and didn't do anything, so this community advocate who was murdered comes back to life as a zombie, and they're like screaming like Looney Tunes characters, now would be a good time to panic, whoop, 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 whoop. and it really just takes away from, okay, this guy just, you know, dragged into a grave by his dick. You know? And it's like, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about that. I mean, am I supposed to think this is scary? Or am I supposed to think this is funny? Or is this supposed to be satisfying to me as a viewer? Because, yeah, all right, it was. You know, I mean, clearly the viewer is, you know, supposed to be on the side of this, you know, this zombie. But I just, like, I don't know what I was supposed to come away with, you know, thinking in this particular segment. This probably worked the least well for me because, again, just a very inconsistent in tone.
The story is essentially catharsis.
And yeah.
So from that standpoint, it's just dramatically it's just meant to be like, yeah, I don't like racist cops because who the fuck does? But it does make one wonder how this particular crew has been managing to sell drugs and not be caught. But also, you don't want to make them such criminal masterminds that they won't follow a guy who's an ex-partner of theirs drunk into a graveyard. So, yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things that on its face is just meant to be this catharsis. And so dramatically, it doesn't so much make sense because that's not really its goal. It's just meant to make you feel like, oh, there's some justice in this world, in a world that has very little justice in it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a dozen different ways that it could have been done better. And I just did not think that the way he chose was the best one.
I agree. It has some cool visuals in it. When that one guy transforms into a mural, I enjoyed that because it's goopy and I enjoy goopy face effects.
Yeah. For a quick second, I was like, what were in those needles? Oh, okay. He's turning into, or they're like, you know, are people shooting up, you know, hydrochloric acid? Why is his face? Oh, he's in the painting. Okay.
Oh, I haven't seen a fully furnished alleyway quite like that since Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, which seems to promote an idea of New York in which every alleyway comes with a living room set. Like, you just reveal part of The Price is Right behind every corner. And this is a little bit like that. But, of course, you get rusty trash cans on fire, which is not something that is an L.A. thing. I hate to break it to everybody, but in Los Angeles, we don't have trash cans on fire.
That's... Well, it's never cold. It's never cold enough there that anybody needs to be warming their hands over anything.
Well, if you're out of doors, man, it ain't exactly. Like last night, it got down to 45. Now, I'll grant you.
Oh, Jesus, 45.
Listen, 45. But we're built a little bit differently when during the day it's up to 77. Like, you know, it's a desert. It gets colder at night. We just watered the fuck out of this place and stole some land.
Okay. Every morning, it's like 25 around here.
Oh, that's terrible.
I'm not complaining.
You should move.
I'd love to. I kind of mixed on the not subtle historical nods throughout this, especially the first one.
Yeah.
Which I guess we can just go segment to segment. So the first one, the community leader is Martin Moorhead, which is obviously like Martin Luther King, Moorhead College, which it's on one hand, it's like I appreciate the nods, but other hand, it's like, can you go a little more subtle? But I understand it's a anthology film, so it's kind of like you have to get your idea in quick, make sure it's noticeable, and then wrap up the story. So I don't know, it's kind of like the curse of the anthology film of, like, you have to just tell, get the idea across the simplest and quickest way.
Yeah. Well, in particular, Moorhead came across to me like Johnny Cochran, who, before his involvement in the O.J. Simpson trial, had primarily made a name for himself with police brutality cases. And had a long history of being pulled over by the police, basically to intimidate him. So I think that probably resonated very quickly with the audience at the time, as they saw it. And, you know, there's all the other grander things here, but in particular, it really reads like, you know, Los Angeles, 1992, 1993, probably when it was all being written.
Yeah, probably. And the cop played by Wings Hauser is named after Supreme Court Justice Strom Thurmond, who opposed the Civil Rights Bill and was like openly racist, but he had a black mistress and has a biracial daughter. So like,
I feel like that's every character Wings Hauser has played.
Good guy, bad guy, they're all that. Yeah,
I feel like Wings Hauser, every character Wings Hauser has played has been inspired by a virulent racist who had a secret black mistress.
It's just under the surface, and then it's very much on the surface, depending on how much cocaine Wings had had that particular day.
Yeah, and yesterday I was recording with Joel, and I mentioned that, and Joel said, "Oh, he's playing himself."
Yeah, I mean, we talk about typecast actors, but we don't talk enough about Wings Hauser. It's like you play a murderous pimp once, you play a murderous pimp the rest of your life.
But he plays I mean, this is not faint praise. He plays the best murderous pimp in Vice. That is such an insane movie. And his performance basically carries the entire thing, because the cops in that, talk about weird tones, are all fucking Looney Tunes themselves. Like, I don't feel protected with them being in charge of anything. And he just mows through people over the course of that film in a way that is incredible. And I don't think he ever lived it down. And maybe he shouldn't have. Because, you know, well past his very public, you know, substance abuse issues, he was forever locked as either a terrible bad cop or a terrible bad person, and occasionally a ghost carpenter.
All right. I forgot who says it in that segment, but it might be Wings. One of them calls Clarence, the rookie cop, a fruitcake. And I saw a thing like, wait. Like, he didn't do anything, like, he didn't flirt with them. Why are they calling him a gay slur?
Well, fruitcake, just I think, assholes? Is... Well, fruitcake is, I think, just, you know, you're crazy. It's a charmingly, at this point, kind of archaic term for calling someone who's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like Foghorn Leghorn, that boy's nuttier than a fruitcake.
Oh, okay.
Which I love. I love that phrase so much.
It's just not used in modern vernacular quite as much. But if you were to have watched a sitcom from 1972 to 1986, you would have seen it.
Oh, all right. I don't know. Like, I like the zombie golem aspect of like gain revenge on the cops who kill them, because it's kind of, I feel like basically like a golem, like mummy curse type deal where it keeps showing up like Jason. But like you can like explain away the teleporting or like Jason stuff, as you guys talked about. Like you can't explain away like Jason just appearing, or like this is like it justifies like, yeah, it's supernatural. It doesn't have to make logical sense how he's appearing everywhere.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, someone was dragging a movie they had seen in Sundance. And was stating how, you know, it started to violate its own rules. And I know everyone's very hung up on this idea of horror movies need to have rules. And we have talked about it ad nauseum on the show of Jason, you know, how does he work or how does Freddy work? But both those franchises and the vast majority of the movies that we watch establish rules and instantly violate them so that you can actually surprise people. And we have to get over this idea that horror movies have to have rules, because almost none of them, and especially the really, really good ones, don't. So get over your fucking self. It's like plot holes. You're not smarter because you recognized your own headcanon and decided, oh, this is how this works. In reality, in order to surprise, you're going to have to establish one methodology and then switch it halfway through so that people don't get bored. Sorry, everyone. This zombie teleports. What are you going to do? He already rose up out of a fucking grave, right? He's got telekinesis.
You're kind of just already, you know, you have to suspend your belief a little bit anyway that, you know, the dead rise and walk the earth. So, you know, why can't they just suddenly, you know, be able to show up wherever you are and you know, again, you know, move stuff with their minds, make people melt into a painting. Why not?
Yeah, sure. He's a fucking curse. Like, curses don't operate in the way of logic. So get over it, dude.
Yeah, it's a golem. It's I'm getting into the Hammer movies and watching the Mummy movies and like the Mummy is asleep. You know, like it goes on a mission to kill certain people and just does that mission until it's done.
Yeah,
and it's the same thing. He goes on a mission to kill his people, and once he's done, he's done. Overall, I don't know. I think the segment is okay. I like the kills. Like, Wings getting his head ripped off is pretty cool.
And you get like Anytime you can watch Wingshauser get his head ripped off is not exactly a bad time. But that's a highlight.
Yeah. But, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a great way to kick it off with, like, the violence. And then get into the best segment with the abused kid, which we talked a little bit about before. Which, let's see, do you guys have any other more thoughts on it? Because there are a few more things, I found, like, the theme of, like, masculinity, like, or with, like, well, black masculinity to be very striking, because, like, the teacher character, played by Rusty, it reminds me of my dad, who is a teacher, who is very understanding and tries to, like, talk his way through problems. And you have, like, you know, like, the violent, aggressive opposite. And it has a good message of, like, you know, like, the violent, aggressive side of things is not the right way to go. And I just seeing the character reminds me of my dad, like, I think really helps me, make that segment even more.
It feels like the most fleshed out of all the stories. Like I said, I think this is probably the one he put them. I don't want to say he put the most thought into, but it seems like the one where he had a clear vision of what he wanted to do and what he wanted to say with it. And I don't think that is present quite as much in the other three.
Yeah, it's a very thought out and complex segment, and you're not. And I think for first time watchers, they won't exactly know where it's heading. You know, are you getting that Twilight Zone sort of, you know, he's wishing people into the cornfields type power? Is he bringing this about, or is this viewing real experiences as magical realism? There's a lot going on underneath the surface of it, and I think it's one of the more successful. It feels like, as Gina said, this is the one he put the most thought into, and it really comes across. It's the highlight.
Like, it wouldn't surprise me that he came up with the idea of this, but didn't think it would work as a full length movie. And then kind of came up with other stories around it and thought, well, I'll make an anthology.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's bold, because again, anthologies, a lot of them don't work. I am not a fan of the ABCs of murder or something. Mm-hmm. Those are not good. Like, you've got, like, you know, a hit or miss rate of about, you know, five misses to every one hit. And because it's particularly so with that, where they're all done by different writers and directors, here at least there is a common thread of the in this, of, you know, redemption and you know, good versus evil and you know, people paying for their sins in horrendous ways, and that works. But this one, again, feels like the one that had the most, you know, concern and thought into making it a genuinely compelling story. And I think that there's a reason why this is the one that most people, that people remember the most out of the four of them.
And it has a denouement that stands out from the crowd. You don't have a lot of endings like the ending here. And as a result, it feels unique. Like, I've seen a lot of movies where people get their heads ripped off. So your results may vary there. But you don't really see how the villain here is going to bite it before it actually happens. And it is instantly memorable. And I think well done for the time. It's got some serious makeup effects going on here. And it looks cool. And I enjoy everyone's performances, bird shit notwithstanding.
Yeah. And the kid, Walter, and it reminds me of the kid from the Transfiguration a bit, like the weird outsider kid, which I connect with that a little bit too. Which I don't know if you guys have seen the Transfiguration, but it's a very grim vampire movie similar to Martin.
I like it already.
Yeah, it's on Shudder. Just be prepared. It's very unpleasant after a certain point. But it's very good. And you get to see Lloyd Kaufman get killed in it, which is pretty fun.
Always down for that, yeah.
And I think what's the guy's name? The guy who did Deranged, that new Frankenstein movie?
Larry Fessenden.
I believe he's in it, and he gets killed.
He gets killed a lot. I don't think I've seen a movie he's in yet where he does not die in it.
Yeah,
he's like the indie Steve Buscemi. You know, kind of very distinctive looking, you know, sort of plays a lot of sketchy characters, almost invariably gets killed.
Well, and he's a bit of a godfather in the indie horror movement, because of Glass Eye Picks. So a lot of people have come through that particular mill and sort of revere his contributions to the indie horror, you know, people who are sort of now on top of their game. A lot of them came through there in one form or the other. So, yeah, he's quite revered in the scene.
Oh, okay. Moving on from that, there is the segments have proper names, but in my notes, just wrote down based off what Clarence Williams' character said. So, the Dollhouse, which Joel's not here, but he told me yesterday, that's his favorite segment because he loves Corbin Burnson.
I'm really dating myself here, but I cannot picture Corbin Burnson as anybody else, anything but a slightly sleazy lawyer. He'll always be Arnie on L.A. Law to me.
He's trapped in Amber there, yeah.
Yeah.
Joel loves the show Psych, and Corbin plays a character on that. So I think that's why he loves it so much, honestly.
This one, I think, out of all of them, worked the least well for me. Because again, I don't know what I was supposed to think of this character. He just seemed like kind of an idiot, and also, you know, he was very unsubtle in the way that he spoke, and it's like Rusty Cundiff didn't trust the audience to get that this guy's supposed to be a racist. And it's like I got it, you know. I don't know that you need to, you know, have the N-word be the every other word comes out of his mouth. I get it, and I understand that these people do talk like that. I get that. It's just, you know, I sort of feel like he didn't trust the audience to understand what he was trying to say about this character and what makes his ultimate comeuppance so satisfying. But that being said, I do love the noise that the little doll makes when he attacks him. He makes this awesome little sound. I loved it. It was so cute.
I find the stop motion animation of those dolls instantly charming.
Oh, I love stop motion. I love stop motion animation. It's my favorite. I love it so much.
Yeah, this one feels like it's referencing the Trilogy of Terror.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Segment. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very Zuni fetish doll that you can tell he's like, we got to have something that's along those lines, and that's hard to do because talk about a movie that suffers from its best segment. I think that particular Tales from Terror it, the only thing people remember is that Karen Black Zuni fetish doll segment. And it's so good, and it's so visceral, and it's so brutal, and the ending is so awesome that everything that sort of plays on that, that's trying to get to that kind of thing, suffers a little bit in comparison to it. But then again, I really love the stop motion animation of it. I just wish they had found a way to, because obviously the Corbin Burdson character is playing a David Duke type, but
yeah, I mean, he is called Duke and he's running for office. So it's like,
yes,
if you know, like the, when did David Duke run for president? Like the late '80s, was it president he was running for?
Yeah. Yes. I think it was late '80s. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was during the Poppy Bush era. So,
and yeah. Regrettably, he's still around.
Yeah, unfortunately, God has not struck him down in the street, as I've wished. For whatever reason, evil continues to live.
He has not shit himself to death, which is my wish for every evil person.
Yeah, if he could just die, that would be neat. If I'll just send that out to the universe. If he could die in a horrible way, the way he deserves, that'd be cool.
And allegedly, he's upset over Black Klansman for how it portrayed him.
Oh, like a fucking idiot? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he doesn't come off any better in this either.
So it's consistent in media, at the very least. David Duke is a complete fucking dolt. Nothing new here. That being said, I think what makes it weird is the whole, I have this political fixer who's going to help me with my image, and that whole thing kind of comes off like, who the fuck has taken this job? And then he's taking this? Oh, come on. It's like one step too far, whereas Art Evans being drafted into this to yell at Corbin Burdson, I would like more of that. I just want more of Art Evans yelling at people. It's enjoyable.
Yeah, the fixer guy is Roger Smith. He shows up in Spike Lee movies here and there, and he's like a theater guy and writes plays. And so, like, seeing him, I like seeing him in this, but overall, I think this might be my least favorite segment. It's just, I don't know, it's, like, I don't find any dolls to be scary or effective, but I like the stop motion stuff a whole lot. Like the message here is very simple. It's not really nuanced necessarily, and but like it has some cool effects. Like the painting keeps like you see a white spot for every time a doll comes to life, and it's just a pretty cool effect. But outside of that, it's I don't know. It's kind of dull.
Yeah, I overall, you know, this wouldn't have worked for me anyway because, like, killer doll movies just do nothing for me. I just, like, they I'm not a particular, I mean, I enjoy the concept of, like, the Puppet Master movies and Child's Play and stuff like that, and I find some of them entertaining, but on a level where they're supposed to be scary, not in the least. I don't know why people just aren't spending, you know, trying to flee from these by kicking at them, or perhaps dropping a large box on them. I understand the idea of a doll coming to life being frightening, and perhaps for like a split second you don't know what to do about it, but there are 101 things that a grown, you know, adult could do to a several inches tall doll to you know, stop it from attacking them. So yeah, it's a genre of horror film that really just leaves me cold. So even if it had been the best constructed movie or segment in the movie, I still probably wouldn't have cared for it that much.
Yeah. Also, like it, there's a Twilight Zone that's similar to it, the one with Agnes Moorehead, mm-hmm. where she has to fight off these aliens. Yeah, they're like the size of dolls. It's a pretty good episode. I think she is silent the whole time. And but there is some dialogue in the opening, but it's an okay one.
My favorite of the genre is actually the Stephen King short story Battleground.
Okay, now see, that's a good one. I think that that works. I think it works better as a story when you can just kind of more visualize it.
It works better in your head.
Yeah. That one, I was actually thinking of that when I was talking about that. Yeah, that one, that works as a better concept because they actually have weapons. Their weapons aren't just, you know, they're jumping at you and gnawing on your leg. You know,
I mean. And they're equal. They're equals in terms of skill level because he's a hitman. And then they're army figures. And so they all have weapons. They're using tactical ways to bring him down. And for whatever reason, and also it's over fast.
Yes.
Like, it's not a feature-length story. Like, it is short here. Whereas this particular segment in Tales of the Hood, you know, it's probably 15 minutes long and feels like it's 7 or 8 minutes too long there. It feels like there's filler, and then Corbin Birdson falls over, and it's over. Like, there's not a lot of strategy involved in it, and it isn't a test of will like Zuni Fetish Doll is. Like, that, you know, she is struggling to stay alive for the vast majority of that runtime, and no matter what she does to kind of put anything between her and that doll, he seems to find a way around it, and so it becomes a real test of wills. Whereas here, once the dolls are revealed, it's kind of like, well, are they coming to life and killing him? And you're like, no, wait 5 minutes. And then they are revealed, they come after to kill him, and it's like 90 seconds later, it's done. Like, okay, but it's not as satisfying as I want it to be. I want them to dehumanize him in order for the emotional impact to really work.
Whereas honestly, for me, I think it would have been pretty cool if he had been turned into a little doll at the end somehow.
Yeah,
I think that would have worked better. Yeah. Just other than instead of just, I guess they ate him.
Well, he's good eating, Gina. That's what it comes down to. If you can take a bite of Corbin Birdson, most people don't tell you this because you'll be thrown in jail. But he is delicious.
Yeah, I watched this yesterday and I already forgot how it ended. It's like, it's that forgettable. But like the only good thing about it aside from like the painting motif is he beats the painting with an American flag. He keeps using the American flag to beat the dolls with, which is a great piece of not subtle symbolism.
Yeah, the farther this movie goes, the less subtle it becomes. But I would assume that, given its target audience, that you know it might have the catharsis would have been real. So I can't discount it in that circumstance, but no, it's not subtle.
Yeah.
I just wish it was. I just wish it had gone better. Farther. It feels like something was holding a couple of these segments back from really going full tilt, batshit. And I wish it had gone. Whether that was a failure of imagination, a failure of budget, because the farther you go with this stuff, the more makeup and special effects and all that stuff has to be involved. You know, it feels like something was holding a couple of these things back from really going full tilt boogie. And I almost said boogie like a Canadian. My apologies. Full tilt boogie.
All right. So then there's a last segment, which ties into the end of the movie. I was getting madness is another name for it, but who cares?
This one felt a little bit like a chick tract.
What is the uniform policy inside of this prison experiment? Because a couple outside of Rosalind Cash, everyone else is dressed like they're in a music video. And do they wear their uniforms to the prison?
I was gonna say sex club. This felt like more fetishy to me than a music video.
Well, the way Rosalind Cash screws in that dude's cock towards the end of it. Definitely feels like someone's working through some issues. And
I mean, like, do you think that the it's saying something about like fetishization and commodification of black male bodies, or do you think I'm reading way too much into it?
No, that's what it's trying to say. It's not subtext; it's the text.
Well, okay. I didn't want to, like, you know, read into it. I mean, I realize he's trying to say some stuff in this, and, you know, some are more successful than others at it.
I mean, certainly this particular segment takes the greatest leap of all of them by bringing in an actual element of stark reality, in that in the midst of his sort of Clockwork Orange forced vision element, we're actually rather inundated with historical photographs of lynchings. And that is, I mean, that's a fucking choice, y'all.
And it is, and that's where the issue of tone comes in. Because some of this movie is, you know, I'll say it's supposed to be funny. I don't know that that a lot of the humor in it worked, but then it ends with this very serious, you know, sort of treatise against, you know, black on black violence and racism, and you know, it's got a very disorienting, you know, I think it's like straight 5 minutes of flashing lights and, like, you know, subliminal and unsubliminal imagery, and I wonder how many people kind of came out of this movie, you know, kind of disoriented and all. I mean if you if you go into a theater now that has even a second or two of you know, strobe imagery, they have signs posted outside of theaters, and, you know, I can't imagine someone sitting through that and, you know, not understanding why they started feeling sort of out of it. But yeah, I mean, and again, this ends on such a bleak note that it doesn't really go with, again, a couple of bumbling cops getting their dicks and heads ripped off by a zombie, you know? I mean, it you know, because the humor in that was so broad and goofy, and then to end on something that's just not funny at all, it's very jarring.
Yeah, it comes out of nowhere. But I do understand there's an element here to the entire film is sort of looking at the predominant depiction that one would be seeing in the media at that moment in time, with gangster rap being at its zenith at that moment. You know, everything past 1992 carries with it, you know, everything that the Dr. Dre album has, and it just sort of envelops popular culture to a certain degree. And I have to believe that a lot of filmmakers at the time might have rebelled from being forced into one type of movie, that Boys in the Hood was such a phenomenon that if you're being forced into the pocket of pitching everything that has to do with this particular lifestyle and this particular type of black man, that would be fucking tiresome. Like, you're contributing to perhaps something that you don't want to contribute to, regardless of the fact that those are stories worth telling and those are people whose circumstances they're not completely under their control. There's a systemic element to this that, you know, we're still fucking living in. Let's just put it out there. But
oh yeah, if you're watching it from a modern perspective, you're watching a lot of this. You're watching a lot of, you know, racist cops and racists running for president. I'm like, well, thank God we solved that problem.
Yeah, so thank goodness we locked that away in a box and threw it in the ocean. We don't have to deal with it ever again.
Yeah, what a shame to look on our past like this.
Mm-hmm. But that segment is particularly, it is powerful, but it is discordant with a lot of the things that come before it. So it's definitely a choice. It is taking a large swing. So I will grant it that. Like, I think some thought went into it. It's whether or not it works is in the eye of the beholder.
That's true. All right. I don't have much to say about this segment. I found it kind of repetitive for the most part. Like, the flashing lights got, for me, kind of really fucking annoying after a certain point. And then, like, outside of the mad science, like, retro horror aspect of it, it's kind of, like, it didn't really do much for me. Outside, you know, like Patrick, you were saying, like, it doesn't make a point about this, like, black life in America, but at the same time, it's just kind of, it just doesn't, it seems like maybe save it for something else, to, like, do something goofier here. It's a weird fit.
Well, yeah, in the end, the you know, the guy that she, I guess she's supposed to be rehabilitating him?
Supposedly, yes.
And, but, you know, at the end, he's like, fuck you, it's not my fault, and, you know, well, okay, I guess he's in hell now. You know, and again, that's where I feel like it kind of ultimately feels like a chick tract.
Yes. It is hampered by not having an ending. Because essentially it's setting up the ending of the wraparound.
Yeah, it's got a little touch of Tyler Perry in that, like, yeah. You know, it ends up being weirdly, you know, biblical, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, now these people are in hell for their sins.
Yes, it feels very church play.
And the end is pretty fun. Mr. Sims transforms into the devil.
Oh, he's so great. He's so great.
It's fucking amazing. It's literally, I do feel like the movie is worth it for watching his performance, because you're seeing someone commit to just commit with every ounce of his being. And he is so good in this. To me, it's practically career defining, because he is incredible on screen. He's so charismatic. And you're like, where is this guy from? And then it's revealed he's from hell. You're like, yeah, that makes sense.
and I always want to know. I always want to know: does he do this kind of elaborate, you know, service for everybody that enters hell? Like, it's like, well, I died. I'm in hell now. Oh, here's somebody telling me four horrifying stories.
I do hope that every time someone enters hell, someone's like, hold on, I've got some stories to tell. All right.
He should be like, have you seen the movie Asylum from the 70s? It's kind of like this.
Yes. No.
Yeah.
I am not.
Asylum, it's a Amicus anthology movie that basically just really steals the structure of where it's like they go to different rooms. It's like, where, like, in asylum, it's they go to different patients, and how they ended up there is a story. And for here, it's like every time you open the coffin, it's a new segment.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of those Christian haunted houses that you go to, where it's like, here's the girl that had an abortion. You know, here's the boy. Here's the boy that tried a marijuana cigarette. They're all in hell now.
yeah. It's like,
so do you guys want to know the wraparound for a sequel?
Sure, but I had one question. Yeah. So after everything that happened to the poor cop in the first one, where, you know, he you know, regretted being a coward, and, you know, got to see this zombie, witness a zombie rise up and you know, get revenge in a, you know, number of horrifying ways, and then he ends up in the mental hospital to blame for the other cops, says, is he supposed to be in hell too? Why is he in hell?
The rookie cop from the
beginning? Yeah, because he's in the. I assume that every time he shows somebody in a casket, they're in hell.
Oh, I don't know.
I was like, that's not very nice. that poor boy has been through enough.
Yeah, and he's obviously torn about it. Like, he doesn't know how to deal with it in life, so. You know, he's asked by a zombie demon to get the cops back to the graveyard, and he does. Like,
that's very judgmental, Rusty Cundiff.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
But you were saying you heard the wraparound for the sequel.
For a sequel. Okay, so Keith David is a new Mr. Sims, which is a step up, but it kind of sucks because everything else is terrible. Mm. So it's a future prison where the warden is making robots that have lasers so that they can punish minorities. And so he brings in Mr. Sims to tell stories to AI to put into the robots so it can know who to punish and harass.
Spencer, I don't know what you're talking about. That sounds amazing.
I mean, if you were trying to sell it,
I mean, that's a hell of an elevator pitch right there.
It sounds pretty cool until you watch it. It's like, oh no, this is everything that could go wrong.
As much as I love the genre, that's so many horror movies. It sounds cool until you watch it.
I mean, that's pretty much half of the movies we've ever covered on our show. So,
yeah. It's almost 2 hours, though. So, it's on Netflix if you want to watch a sequel. And the first segment has a gollywog come to life and impregnate a white woman who gives birth to baby gollywogs. And that's the end. She dies in childbirth, giving birth to little gollywogs. And it goes places.
Mystical, magical places.
And listeners, if you don't know what gollywog is, look it up. Just look it up. Patrick, I know you have a heart out, so thank you for your time. And what 1995 movie would you recommend?
You know, I started looking it up when it was mentioned at the top, and Gino was absolutely right at the time. This was a weirdly, really solid year of good movies. I mean, there is some really amazing stuff in there. There's some terrible things. But you know what I feel compelled to get people to watch again is Desperado. Desperado is a hell of a fucking action movie. And I feel like it's a very much a time capsule of its time. I wonder how modern audiences would really grasp some of the things going on there. But to me, it was a revelation at the time. I love Desperado. And then I'll give some love to the Brady Bunch movie, which is so much funnier than it has any right to be. It is just kind of amazing because at the time, the whole let's make a TV show into a movie thing was rather nascent, and it lampoons all of it. And it has some incredible side performances, and there's a reason why you see it memed everywhere. It's actually quite good. So Desperado, the Brady Bunch movie. That's me.
All right. Gina, I assume you have a couple too?
Yeah, I'm not going to go deeper into with my choices. My first one's going to be Seven. A movie I probably think about at least once a week in the 25 odd years since I've seen it. As Patrick mentioned, this was a very, very front-loaded year for good movies, and I saw a lot of movies in the theater because where I was living at the time, that was all there was to do. So I definitely remember seeing Seven in the theater. My most vivid memory of it is everybody in the theater just filing out in stunned silence afterward, because I honestly think that might have been the first time I'd ever seen a movie that ended so bleakly as Seven did. I think at the time nobody really knew, like, I mean, of course now everybody knows, you know, it's like a big iconic spoiler of what happens at the end of it, but I wish I could remember what I thought was going to happen. I assumed that ultimately that somebody, either Morgan Freeman or Brad Pitt, killing Kevin Spacey would be Wrath. I was like, yeah, I don't think I was sitting there counting on my fingers thinking, hey, wait a minute, he forgot one. if I had, it may have occurred to me, oh, okay. But it's just such a, you know, when you think about it now, it's like, oh, that's fucking genius. That is fucking genius how that worked out. And as much as it pains me to give Kevin Spacey any kind of credit, he really is really good in this movie, and he is I really enjoy a movie villain, whether in horror or otherwise, who is always very calm, doesn't have to result to a lot of, you know, screaming and histrionics and all, and he's very, very effectively creepy in it. And I think this is the first... This was also, which is funny, because my follow-up movie, is, I was going to mention, was 12 Monkeys. And this 1995 was the year when America realized, hey, that Brad Pitt fellow, he's actually a pretty good actor. Because up to that point, he was mostly, you know, the hot guy that Gina Davis picks up in Thelma and Louise. You know, he hadn't done...
He's a stoner in True Romance.
Yeah, and the guy who stands around and does nothing in Cool World.
He has a haircut.
He has an interesting haircut, much like he did in Johnny Suede, which is, you know, all that he can remember for that. But he wasn't trying at that point. He was like, you know, somebody told him, you're a good looking guy. You don't have to do anything more than that. Just stand around and be good looking. And then at some point he decided, you know what? I'm going to push myself a little bit. So he started taking interesting roles. Like he, you know, plays a kind of, you know, beaten down cop in Seven, which he did very well at. And he played a crazy person in 12 Monkeys, which he was very good at, like shockingly good at. He, you know, wore these contacts that made his eyes look like they were looking in two different directions, which is always a really creepy effect. I apologize to people who have a lazy eye, but it's, you know, in certain settings, it's very effective. You know, he's got this scene where he's talking and his eyes are just rolling around, and I'm like, damn, that's good. How is he doing that? And 12 Monkeys is also a movie I find myself thinking about often, and I realize inadvertently I pick movies that predominantly feature people who turn out to be terrible human beings. You know, Seven has Kevin Spacey, 12 Monkeys was directed by Terry Gilliam, and this is something that I have to, you know, that I'm still working out with myself, is, you know, how do I feel about still thinking these are good movies, and whether, you know, how these people turned out to be stains these movies somewhat, and that's, you know, something that, you know, being berated about on Twitter aside, that I have to, you know, kind of work out with myself. But, you know, particularly now with, you know, we're in the era that 12 Monkeys kind of sort of takes place in, and it's very unsettling, and it's one of the, you know, if you, as long as you're not a stickler about time travel movies and you're one of the people that believes you can't exist in the same space as a different version of yourself, it's very spooky, the whole idea that the person he's seeing in his childhood flashbacks was him. And I remember seeing in the theater and being like, what? And I looked at my boyfriend at the time, we were just like, what? Like, literally looking at each other with, like, mouths agape. It's like, that's him? And it's just, it's so, again, well-crafted. It's a shame the person that came up with it just turned out to be a real son of a bitch. And you know, and I think that we're going to have to see that a lot with a lot of movies from this era. It's still a good movie, though. I mean, I can't deny it. It's still a very unique, vision of a dystopian future that actually, at this point, doesn't seem all that, you know, implausible.
Yeah. Mine is Tommy Boy. It's really funny. It makes me laugh. I have nothing profound to say about it besides it just makes me laugh. So you guys have a podcast and a Patreon,
we do?
I believe?
We do?
Oh, this is news to me. We do. It's called Kill by Kill. We go through horror movies one death at a time. It took us 2.5 years to get through the entire Friday the 13th franchise. It's taken us a little more than a year to get through A Nightmare on Elm Street, and we're about to reach our zenith, our high point, and that is Freddy versus Jason. And I don't know how long it's going to take us to get through that movie.
We keep putting it off. People die. We just keep like putting other movies in front of it.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to it, but not looking forward to it. It's a real interesting monkey's paw, as it were.
I'm looking forward to the luxurious long beard I'm going to grow while we're talking about it.
that corn maze rave alone is going to take us a million years.
We do also have a Patreon. It's just patreon.com/killbykill.
Yeah.
And as a listener, since you guys started, highly recommend the podcast. It's funny. It introduced me to stuff like Pieces. And
I love that we become associated with Pieces.
Pieces is great.
I mean, it's stupid. Great.
It is something.
It's stupid shit, but it's great. But yeah, and thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you.
A fun, stupid idea. And what's going on? Around this time will be the Clockers episode with Martin Kessler and the Ivan Dixon double feature with The Spooky Set by a Door and Nothing But a Man. So this will be like a fun little silly episode between like two serious ones. And I see you guys for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.